Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There. This is a podcast about the outdoors, from your window box and garden, to the fields on the edge of town, to the forests, prairies, seashores, and wilderness. On the show, we explore our relationship with nature through stories, interviews, essays, and even some fiction. We travel around the U.S. and the world with tales of love and heartbreak, passion and adversity, desperation and triumph.
I will admit, I had a crush on Fred. The first time I saw a photo of Fred, his face and everything about him just struck me. This beautiful young man. He was kind of scruffy, he looked a little unshaven, but he had this angelic, joyful smile on his face, standing next to what I thought was a horse. It turned out to be a mule, and I thought, what is his story? That was my second thought, because my first thought was, oh, isn't he beautiful?
This is Lynn Downey. She's a historian in Sonoma, California. And at 62, she's been experiencing a phenomenon not uncommon for women her age. A bit of an obsession with a younger man. That obsession led her on a trip through the vast expanses of Nevada and through time. And it all started with this photograph.
He looked like the kind of young man that spent hours, if not his entire life, outdoors. In this photo, there he is very close to his mule, and his clothes were a little dirty, like he was used to being in the outdoors. And I thought, here is a real Western man.
Many of us have been there, a bit of a crush bordering on an obsession. We can't get enough. But for Lynn, it was a bit different. In her case, the object of her obsession, this young man she's just been describing, lived almost 150 years ago.
I was fascinated to find out what brought Fred out west. I had to know everything. I had to track his family down, and I had to learn everything about him because I needed to know the source of that smile on his face. What made him so happy?
Lynn's story begins when she first discovered Fred while going through archives in a small town in Arizona.
About 13 years ago, I decided to do some research on the little town of Wickenburg, Arizona, northwest of Phoenix. And in the course of doing this research, I learned about a horrendous massacre that happened on November 5th, 1871, just a few miles outside of Wickenburg. And it was in the course of this research that I first met Fred. There are a few books out there about Wickenburg history in general, and all of them discuss this massacre from 1871, and they all carried this one photograph that when I saw it and I read the caption and it said Frederick Wadsworth Loring, my obsession started. It turns out that Frederick Loring is from a Boston Brahmin family. He was a graduate of Harvard, and yet he chose to drop everything and join a Western expedition just for the experience. He was born in Boston in 1848. His family, the Lorings, were publishers. He went to Harvard. Even before he graduated, he published poetry. He published a novel. He was the kind of young man who didn't have a callus on his hand. And from those hands came some of the most amazing journalism of the 19th century. Fred joined the Wheeler Expedition, or the Wheeler Survey. Lieutenant George Wheeler's survey went through California, Utah, Arizona, and Nevada, charting where mines were, the possibilities for military posts, that kind of thing. And Fred, in our modern terms, was embedded with the survey as the sort of secretary and journalist. And wherever he went, he filed stories for a magazine called Appleton's Journal, which was published out of the East. So here is this boy who's never been out west, who took the train to San Francisco and from May to October of 1871 went over some of the most rugged, arduous, dangerous territory in the American West and filed chirpy stories about going to the Chinese Theater in San Francisco, meeting Brigham Young in Utah, talking about crossing Death Valley in the summer. His writing is amazing to me. The journalism really reflects the fact that he was a 19th century white young man. But if you just look through that and you read his words and you realize he must have been smiling for those entire few months because you can feel the interest and the excitement that he had. There isn't one word of complaint in all of these articles, except that I believe at the end of the Death Valley one, he said he hoped never to see the like of that place ever again. As I'm talking right now, I am in Wickenburg, Arizona. It's mid-June, and it's 115 degrees today. I'm in an air-conditioned room. I drove down here from Las Vegas in an air-conditioned Prius, in complete comfort. Think about, and this is what I do think about all the time, what it was like to be on foot, on horseback. Just think about what it was like to cross Death Valley in July and August, because I actually think they went across Death Valley twice with nothing. They had no ice. They couldn't refrigerate their food. What did they eat? You know, what was it like, you know, for them to go through this? Whenever I think about Fred traveling these terrible places, what did he hear? What did he smell? What did he feel? Did he feel the heat? Did he feel the cold? For me, learning about people from the past, especially people that I'm so obsessed with like Fred, I want to know how it felt for them. Every single sense, all five of the senses, I wish I could experience what he experienced. Just crossing the parking lot to get from my car to the lovely air-conditioned lobby of my motel, I'm sweating like mad. I would never have survived that trek across Death Valley. What did Fred have to allow him to survive? What was it in his Boston upbringing that gave him the kind of strength to do that and come through the Valley of Death, which is what he called Death Valley, to his next adventure? It astonishes me. Its heat is its greatest terror, for there is abundance of water in the canyons which open into its western side, so that thirst is to be feared more from the concealment than the scarcity of the springs. But its beauty is evil, and though it is picturesque, it is frightful. I trust I may never have to pass through it again. Those are the last lines of Fred's article called Into the Valley of Death, which ran on November 18, 1871, in Appleton's Journal. There's a temptation when we look at history to think it's just, you know, it's just a story from the past, sort of one or two dimensional. But if you think about it, there's really no difference between young people from the past and young people today. Young people want to take chances. They want new experiences. In 1871, Fred Loring wanted new experiences. And for him, the pinnacle of that was a Western expedition. I will probably never know for sure exactly why Fred signed on with the Wheeler Survey, but I have a theory. A lot of artists were coming from the East, coming out West, and painting these extraordinary canvases of Yosemite and the Grand Canyon, and a lot of these artists were displaying their works in art galleries back East. Certainly, they were doing it in Boston. Fred probably saw some of these paintings. There were also writers who were talking about the West and publishing amazing stories about the West, and I'm sure that he read those as well. It is a goal of mine to retrace the Wheeler Survey. I wish I could do it all at once, but that's not possible. So in October of 2015, my boyfriend and I jumped into his Land Cruiser, and we retraced the Nevada portion of the Wheeler Survey. The entire Wheeler Survey is all about the outdoors. It's about these men and their horses and their mules and their chuck wagons and everything grinding away across the hard pan of Nevada. Everywhere we went was someplace that Fred had been. And every town that we stopped in, every landscape that I saw, every picture that Mark took of me in the same spot that Fred might have been just made it so much more real for me. And every place I went, I could hear them. I thought about the nighttime when the sun finally went down and maybe it was cooler and they're all sitting around the fire having their dinner, and I'm sure that one of the soldiers or one of the civilians had a fiddle and they would have had music at night and Fred would have been reading by the firelight. One One of the towns in Nevada that Fred wrote about was a place called Pioche, P-I-O-C-H-E. It's this old mining town in eastern Nevada, and he wrote about how lawless it was. It was almost like something out of Mark Twain. And being in Pioche, we spent the night there, and we met some characters. And I just feel like he would have met the same kind of characters when he and George Wheeler and everybody else came through town. So that was a lot of fun. But I think the place in Nevada where I felt Fred the most was near Battle Mountain, a place called Fort Halleck, which is not there at all anymore. There's nothing but a historical marker off of a road that's off of a road. Fred and the Wheeler Survey spent a lot of time putting the expedition together at Fort Halleck in Nevada. And just standing by that historical marker and looking at the landscape, I could really feel his presence. The Wheeler Survey had stopped in Prescott, and a number of people from the survey were actually on their way home to San Francisco. Fred and two other members of the survey were in this coach that left Prescott. They spent the night in Wickenburg, November 4th, and then they all were on this stagecoach heading west out of Wickenburg, heading for the town of Ehrenberg and the Colorado River, eventually to San Bernardino, and then to make their way up the coast to San Francisco. About 6 or 8 miles outside of Wickenburg, the stagecoach was attacked. There were 8 passengers and a driver. They were attacked by men on horses. Only 2 survived because they ran into the desert. And we think that Fred was one of the first people to die because he was up front with the driver. But the jury is still out about who actually did this ambush or massacre. People in Wickenburg, me included, will still get into arm wrestling contests about, you know, I say it was Indians and I say it was white people dressed as Indians. And I don't know if anybody will ever really know for sure. The word massacre was used by the media in order to make it look as though Indians had done it. Some of the eyewitness reports from the 2 that survived suggest that there were white men, Hispanic men, and some men dressed as Indians. There might have been a few Indians. But the fact that the word massacre was used by the media meant that the media wanted it to be an Indian attack. And this entire episode led to a lot of very, very sad and tragic consequences for the Yavapai Indians, who were the local tribe. One of the things about Fred Loring's story that fascinates me is here was this Eastern boy who wanted an adventure out west, and he got one. I'm sure he expected to go home and take his experiences and he would use that in his writings. But what he ended up being part of was one of the most Western experiences possible, one of the worst Western experiences possible. I first started researching Fred Loring in 2003. And at first, my feelings about Fred were a little bit of a fangirl crush, because he was very cute. What can I say? But 13 years on, my feelings about Fred Loring have really changed. And the more I've learned about him, I've read all of his writings, and the older I get, and the more I learn about how much he lost by dying so young, my feelings have become more maternal rather than girlfriend crush. And I think I like it better this way. I really like this feeling that when I write about Fred, when I talk about Fred, it's not a giggly thing, a giggly girl crush. I want to honor him as a mature writer, writing about another writer who lost his promise. Everyone who died in the Wickenburg Massacre, all of their bodies, we think, were brought back to town, and they were buried here in Wickenburg. But even there are conflicting stories about how maybe 1 or 2 of the men were buried right out there in the desert where they died. As far as I know, Fred's body was not sent back to his family in Boston. And wherever they were buried, that location has been lost to time. And for me, that's another really sad part of the story. And yet, in a way, every time I come to Wickenburg, I know that Fred is still here somewhere. If I ever found Fred's grave, I think I'd want to put a book on his grave. This is the end of his novel, Two College Friends, and he's talking about the death of one of the characters as he sits among the grandeur of the Western outdoors. Okay, here we go. This is the one picture that has been ever before my eyes. Even in the wild regions of Nevada and the undulating lawns and woody slopes of California, in the snow-clad forests of the Sierra Nevada, and even in the tropical glory of sky and air in Arizona, amid the noise and bustle of the camp, with heavenly peace and loveliness above, and murderous savages thirsting for our blood lying in deadly ambush all around, I still have seen this picture. A dead man lying with his face to the earth, while close by his side, one little spot of dust seems blackened and congealed by blood. Every time I read this, I get the chills, because it's almost a premonition of his own death. It's, again, that sort of classic Western experience of beauty, the incredible beauty of the outdoors, and yet the underlying menace of the conflict between Native Americans, Anglo settlers, and soldiers. He saw all of that in those few months that he was out west before he lost his own life. And it's almost as though he might have had an inkling that that could happen to him. But it didn't stop him.
Fred Loring died 6 weeks before his 22nd birthday. Lynn is now finishing up her research and plans to start writing a book about Fred, the stagecoach attack, the Wheeler Survey, and Eastern perceptions of the American West in the 19th century. She says when the book is published, if she ever does find where Fred is buried, she'll put a copy on his grave to honor his memory. This story was produced by Diane Hope. She's an audio producer and journalist based in Flagstaff, Arizona. If you'd like to hear more of her work, you can find her at dianehope.com. Thank you to Mountain Bike Radio and Deb and Vince Garcia for their financial contributions to Out There. If you're enjoying the show and are able to make a donation of your own, you can do so at outthereshow.com. Just click support. Also, if your business is interested in sponsoring the show, you can email me at willow@outthereshow.com. That's it for this episode. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold, and our website is outthereshow.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find me on Twitter at Willow Belden. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.